There are moments in life so rare and profound that they redefine what it means to connect with others. Moments where love isn't confined to the people you know, but it expands to include strangers, people you've never met but feel inexplicably bound to. It's a love born from shared experience, a sense of belonging to something bigger than yourself. It's in these fleeting instances that you feel the impossible, as if thousands of hearts, beating as one, resonate at the same frequency. You look at the stranger next to you and you realize you'd do anything for them, because in that moment, you're not alone. You're together, united by purpose, by hope, by something intangible yet unbreakable. I've been lucky enough to feel this more than once, not just with my community here, with you guys who support me, but with complete strangers, people who didn't necessarily share my beliefs, my dreams, or my story. One of these unforgettable moments happened on July 19th, 2019. I just finished my baccalaureate exams, teetering on the edge of uncertainty, wondering what my future might hold. That night, Algeria was playing Senegal in the African Cup of Nations finals. It wasn't just a game, it was a phenomenon. The air was charged with something electric, something alive. My family and I headed to a nearby stadium where a giant screen broadcasted the match. We sat on the grass, surrounded by families, friends, and strangers, all wearing the same white and green jerseys. I still get goosebumps remembering it. That night, my family grew to include every single one of those people in the crowd, and millions more across the nation. When Algeria scored, the eruptions of joy was indescribable. Strangers embraced like lifelong friends. It wasn't just a goal, it was a victory for all of us. In that moment, I understood the power of community, of unity, of what it means to belong to something greater than yourself. That night deepened my love for Algeria and its people. A love so profound, it defies words. It's why I want to grow, learn, and explore. To bring back every beautiful experience, every bit of knowledge I gather, and pour it back in this country I call home. I want to honor the sacrifices of our ancestors and leave this place better than I found it. And along the way, I've seen glimpses of what I can offer. In a small speaking club called The Hive, I realized the impact I could have on others. I saw how my words and my work could inspire and uplift. For someone who has always stayed behind the screen, it was overwhelming in the best way to feel seen, to feel connected. But with visibility comes vulnerability. Along with love and support, I faced criticism. When I shared that in 5 years, I didn't see myself staying in Algeria, some misunderstood my intentions. They thought I wanted to abandon my roots, my people, to live a glamorous life abroad. Maybe it does seem selfish to dream of living in a bustling, multicultural city, soaking up knowledge, learning from the best and expanding my horizons. But here's the truth. Everything I've ever learned, every experience I've had, I've shared. In my medical YouTube channel, I made sure to turn those 8 hours of studying into 8 minutes videos for fellow students. In this podcast or in my Instagram page, I've always made sure to distill the essence of books and ideas into moments of value for my audience. So yeah, in 5 years, I want to go out there, live in a vibrant, international, multicultural city, to immerse myself in its energy, absorb everything it has to offer, and learn from the best minds out there. Because every bit of that knowledge, every lesson I gather, will be a seed I bring back home. I want to create companies that truly matter, companies that bring immense value to my people, and hopefully to humanity as a whole. To uncover and share knowledge that's been kept out of reach. To break it down and make it accessible to everyone. I want to dissect every step, every strategy, every tool that can help people lead better, more fulfilling lives. So yeah, I want to leave. to grow, to learn, to build. But I also want to return to create companies to share knowledge, to improve lives, and to give back. The thing is, when you put yourself out there, when you post something, you open the door to judgment. Some people latch on to the very first thing you say, without pausing to understand the context or the story behind it. I don't like to judge others, so even when I received a harsh comment, I responded with kindness. Why? Because I can understand where that anger might come from. Imagine watching your country lose its younger generations, watching people leave the land their ancestors fought and died for. That pain is real. That frustration, it's valid. It's sad. It's unfair. But that was never my intention. And deep down, I know I shouldn't feel the need to explain myself or apologize for what I said, because my intentions were good. This entire experience made me reflect on whether I'm ready for the cost of being seen, whether I'm willing to sacrifice pieces of my privacy, my peace, and my serenity in pursuit of the greater good I hope to accomplish. As I wrestled with these thoughts, I came across an episode of The Founders podcast by David Senra. He was talking about the man behind the Inditex Group, the powerhouse behind brands like Zara, Bershka, Pull&Bear, and more. And in David's words, which I'm about to share directly from the transcription here, I guess there's a profound lesson. So here it is. He says a few times that he thinks people overcomplicate things, and so for his life, he just wanted to focus on work. In fact, he was very extreme about privacy. Some people call him a recluse. I don't think he's a recluse, but he does want to protect his privacy. So Ortega was never photographed. Only his friends, families, and co-workers knew what he looked like. This is before Inditex goes public. The author of the book has known Ortega. So Ortega, and this is me talking, Ortega is the man behind the Inditex Group. So let's keep reading. And the author of the book has known Ortega for over 20 years. She had been trying to write a book about him over and over again. And Ortega kept saying, "I don't want a book written about me." He resisted for many years. This is very similar to if you listen to my episode. So that's the episode of David, right? If you listen to my episode on the founder of IKEA a few weeks ago, for a few decades, people kept trying to approach him to write books, and he said no over and over again. Eventually, he agreed just like Ortega does. In fact, there's a conversation in the book about the book. It's a conversation between the author and Ortega, and he is worried. One of the main objections he has to having a book written about him was that he values his privacy and he wanted to keep his life simple. He literally just says, "I just want to work." Here's what he said to her. "You don't realize something very important. I am nobody. I consider myself a worker who is immensely fortunate to have done what he wanted in life and to continue doing it." And when he finally agrees to have the book written, he just asked for two things. Number one, do not only tell good things about me. Something he repeats over and over again is that all humans, all of us, have good and bad parts to us. So don't just say the good things about me. Number two, do not say that I created this company. There had been more than 80,000 people that have helped me build it. He says, "Inditex is the story of many thousands of people who have given their lives to the company." In the impending IPO is the first time that he actually consented and allowed himself to be photographed. But he would explain why this is important to him, why privacy was so important to him. He says, "I only want my family and my friends and the people who work with me to recognize me on the street. I aim to live quietly, to be one among the many, to be able to go anywhere, to have a coffee, to take a walk with my wife without anyone knowing who I am." And then there's this blog post by Tim Ferriss called 11 Reasons Not to Become Famous. In it, he dives into some of the darker sides of fame, things like stalking, receiving inappropriate or even dangerous messages. He explained it with this striking metaphor. This brings me to the topic of audience size and the metaphor of the tribe, the village, and the city. Think back to your fifth grade class. In my case, there were 20 to 30 kids. Was there anyone totally off the rails in your class? For most of you, there's a decent chance kids seemed pretty sane. It's a small, simple size. Next, think back to your freshman year in high school. In my case, there were a few hundred kids. Was there anyone volatile or imbalanced? I can think of at least a handful who were prone to violence and made me uneasy. There were fights. Some kids brought knives to school. There was even a kid rumored to enjoy torturing animals. Keep in mind, this high school was in the same town as my elementary school. What changed? The sample size was larger. The point is this, you don't need to do anything wrong to get threats. You just need a big enough audience. Think of yourself as the leader of a tribe or the mayor of a city. The averages will dictate that you get a certain number of crazies, con artists, extortionists, possibles or actual murderers, and so on. In fairness, we should also include a certain number of geniuses, a certain number of good Samaritans, and so on. Sure, your subject matter and content matters, but it doesn't matter as much as you'd like to think. When I read that, I thought to myself, do I even want to be famous? Truthfully, no. I don't want fame for fame's sake. What I want is to do great work, to share my journey, to help others, and to inspire those who want to achieve more in their lives. Fame is not the goal, it's just a byproduct of showing up, putting myself out there, and connecting with people who resonate with my message. As Austin Kleon puts it in his brilliant book Show Your Work, it sounds a little extreme, but in this day and age, if your work isn't online, it doesn't exist. We all have the opportunity to use our voices, to have our say, but so many of us are wasting it. If you want people to know about what you do and the things you care about, you have to share. And that hit me hard. Keeping my ideas and work to myself feels almost unfair. Think about it. If you believe in something, if you have something valuable to offer, isn't it almost a moral obligation to share it? Steve Jobs once said, if you have something valuable and useful to offer, then you have a moral obligation to do that, both to yourself and to the world. I even remember reading a blog post about an extraordinary yoga teacher. The writer described her as a hidden gem, saying, funny enough, she is also the best kept secret around in the yoga community. She does nothing to promote herself. She has a gift, a rare talent, and a skill at her work, her art, and has for 30 years. This is her brilliance, her unique gift to the world. And yet no one but a handful of random local students know about her. She could impact the lives of tens or hundreds of people suffering from aches and pains and stress and disease and you name it. But she won't be doing that because first and foremost, it takes her telling others about herself so they know about her existence on this good earth of ours. And then the writer asks, but what if you believe in something? What if you have something special to offer and yet you hide it, fearing that you will offend someone? Who suffers then? Who loses out besides yourself? All those people who can help, that's who. So you offend someone, or two someones, or even 10, so what? You get to help a dozen, or 100. Or perhaps you help a single individual transform his or her thinking for the better because of what you do. Now all of that to me is a great trade-off, so those who will be offended, heavens forbid, simply stop to matter in the face of all the change I can bring about. When I read that, I couldn't stop thinking about the sheer responsibility we have to put our work into the world. It's not about being fearless, it's about being brave enough to care more about the good you can do than the criticism you might receive. And if that doesn't put things into perspective, there's always this incredible quote from Steve Jobs, which opens a chapter in Show Your Work about reading obituaries. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There's also something very powerful I heard a few days ago on a reel about Muhammad Ali. Yes, it's pretty extreme and applies to his specific context, but it still helps to put things in perspective. In an interview, someone asked him, "You don't hide from the public. You walk around, you talk to people, you meet people. Have you ever thought about being assassinated?" And Muhammad Ali responded, "I wrote a poem." Here's what he shared in the reel. "Better far from all I see, to die fighting to be free. What more fitting end could be? Better now that I say my sooth. I'm gonna die demanding truth, while I'm still akin to youth. Better now than later on, now that fear of death is gone. Never mind another dawn." He went on to say, "If I get shot, something happened to me. It has to be because someone don't like me for what I believe. Another thing. And I would die for them. And let me tell you something. If somebody want to get you, see, the Holy Quran says, not one soul comes on earth without the permission of Allah, our God. And not one soul leaves without the permission." I mean, seriously, that gives me chills. It's the ultimate reminder. Life is short. And the fear of judgment is trivial in the grand scheme of things. So why should I care about criticism? Why should I be held back by the expectations of others or the fear of being judged? All I should care about is doing meaningful work and helping as many people as I can while staying grounded in my faith and values. At the end of the day, I'm gonna die. We all are. So, does it really matter what people think? Absolutely not. Thinking through all of this, experiencing it, struggling with it, it made me realize something life-changing. I needed to master problem solving. I needed to learn how to make hard decisions, build sound judgment, and face challenges head on. Because let's face it, life is unpredictable. And as a future doctor, isn't it my responsibility to navigate complex problems and make the best decisions for my patients? If I couldn't do that for myself, how could I hope to do it for them? That's when I knew I had to dive deep into this concept, and what better place to start than the Almanac of Naval Ravikant. Now, if you've read it, you know it's not your typical book. It's packed with ideas, sometimes in quotes, sometimes in questions, always thought-provoking. I'll read through it in that style, but I might skip to the answers now and then when it makes sense. Naval begins with a quote about making money. Sure, that's a big part of the book's focus, but even if it doesn't directly apply to problem-solving and decision-making, it sets the tone. If you want to make the maximum amount of money possible, if you want to get rich over your life in a deterministically predictable way, stay on the bleeding edge of trends and study technology, design, and art. Become really good at something. You don't get rich by spending your time to save money. You get rich by saving your time to make money. And then he transitions into something more relevant, hard work and judgment. Hard work is really overrated, but judgment is underrated. My definition of wisdom is knowing the long-term consequences of your actions. Wisdom applied to external problems is judgment. I'll say it again. So my definition of wisdom is knowing the long-term consequences of your actions. Wisdom applied to external problems is judgment. They are highly linked. Knowing the long-term consequences of your actions and then making the right decision to capitalize on that. Isn't that exactly what we're doing here? Thinking about the long-term consequences of our actions, about fame, and trying to make the best decisions we can. Naval continues, "Without hard work, you'll develop neither judgment nor leverage. You have to put in the time, but the judgment is more important. The direction you're heading in matters more than how fast you move, especially with leverage. Picking the direction you're heading in for every decision is far, far more important than how much force you apply. Just pick the right direction to start walking in and start walking. That struck me because I've often made the mistake of rushing into things, focusing on how hard I'm working rather than whether I'm even heading in the right direction. But I think that in the last few years, something shifted and I'm definitely taking my time, so to speak, before heading in a particular direction. Naval also emphasizes clear thinking. Clear thinker is a better complement than smart. The really smart thinkers are clear thinkers. They understand the basics at a very, very fundamental level. I would rather understand the basics really well than memorize all kinds of complicated concepts I can't stitch together and can't redrive from the basics. If you can't redrive concepts from the basic as you need them, you're lost. You're just memorizing. And God knows I've made this mistake countless times in my life. Naval then delves into how to deal with reality. Part of making effective decisions boils down to dealing with reality. How do you make sure you're dealing with reality when you're making decisions? By not having a strong sense of self or judgments or mind presence. The monkey mind will always respond with this regurgitated emotional response to what it thinks the world should be. Those desires will cloud your reality. The number one thing clouding us from being able to see reality is we have preconceived notions of the way it should be. The good news is the moment of suffering. When you're in pain is a moment of truth. It is a moment where you're forced to embrace reality the way it actually is. Then you can make meaningful change and progress. You can only make progress when you're starting with the truth. The hard thing is seeing the truth. To see the truth, you have to get your ego out of the way because your ego doesn't want to face the truth. The smaller you can make your ego, the less conditions you can make your reactions. The less desires you can have about the outcome you want, the easier it will be to see the reality. Imagine we're going through something difficult, like a breakup, a job loss, a business failure, or a health problem, and our friends are advising us. When we're advising them, the answer is obvious. It comes to us in a minute, and we tell them exactly, "Oh, that girl, get over her. She wasn't good for you anyway. You'll be happier, trust me, you'll find someone." You know the correct answer, but your friend can't see it because they're in the moment of suffering and pain. They're still wishing reality was different. The problem isn't reality. The problem is their desire is colliding with reality and preventing them from seeing the truth, no matter how much you say it. The same thing happens when I make decisions. Reading this, I couldn't help but wonder, am I letting my ego get in the way? Am I so caught up in what I want reality to be that I can't see it for what it is? Is it my pride, my fear of being criticized, or my resistance to stepping outside my comfort zone? I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it is, yeah. Naval then suggests making space for thought and reflection. It's actually really important to have empty space. If you don't have a day or two every week in your calendar where you're not always in meetings and you're not always busy, then you're not going to be able to think. You're not going to be able to have good ideas for your business. And you're not going to be able to make good judgments. I also encourage taking at least one day a week, preferably two, because if you budget two, you'll end up with one, where you just have time to think. It's only after you're bored you have the great ideas. It's never gonna be when you're stressed or busy, running around or rushed. Make the time. He also touches on the need to uncondition ourselves. It's really important to be able to uncondition yourself, to take your habits apart and ask, does this still serve me? Does it make me happier? Does it make me healthier? Does it help me accomplish what I set out to do? I try not to have too much I've pre-decided. I think creating identities and labels locks you in and keep you from seeing the truth. To be honest, speak without identity. There are two attractive lessons about suffering in the long term. It can make you accept the world the way it is. The other lesson is it can make your ego change in an extremely hard way. Maybe you're a competitive athlete and you get injured badly, like Bruce Lee. You have to accept being an athlete is not your entire identity, and maybe you can forge a new identity as a philosopher. The classical values are all decision-making heuristics to make one optimize for the long term rather than for the short term. Self-serving conclusions should have a higher bar. I do view a lot of my goals over the next few years of unconditioning previous learned responses or habituated responses, so I can make decisions more clearly in the moment without relying on memory or prepackaged heuristics and judgments. Almost all biases are time-saving heuristics. For important decisions, discard memory and identity and focus on the problem. And then he quotes something by Richard Feynman. I never ask if I like it or I don't like it. I think this is what it is or this is what it isn't. Naval says, it's really important for me to be honest. I don't go out of my way volunteering negative or nasty things. I would combine radical honesty with an old rule Warren Buffett has, which is praise specifically and criticize generally. Now let's dive into something that affects every single one of us every day, whether we realize it or not, which is decision making. During decision making, the brain is a memory prediction machine. A lousy way to do memory prediction is X happened in the past, therefore X will happen in the future. It's too based on specific circumstances. What you want is principles. You want mental models. The best mental models I have found came through evolution, game theory, and Charlie Munger. Benjamin Franklin had great mental models. I basically load my head full of mental models. Mental models are really just compact ways for you to recall your own knowledge. I think a lot of modern society can be explained through evolution. Evolution, thermodynamics, information theory, and complexity have explanatory and predictive power in many aspects of life. Naval then introduces additional concepts that sharpen our decision-making skills, beginning with inversion. I think that Charlie Munger is a big advocate of this inversion principle. I don't believe I have the ability to say what is going to work. Rather, I try to eliminate what's not going to work. I think being successful is just about not making mistakes. It's not about having correct judgment. It's about avoiding incorrect judgments. That brings to mind Matthew McConaughey's process of elimination, as described in his autobiography, Green Lights. Process of elimination and identity. The first step that leads to our identity in life is usually not I know who I am, but rather I know who I'm not. Process of elimination. Too many options can make a tyrant out of any of us. So we should get rid of the excess in our lives that keep us from being more of ourselves. When we decrease the options that don't feed us, we eventually almost accidentally have more options in front of us that do. Knowing who we are is hard. Eliminate who we're not first, and we'll find ourselves where we need to be. It's a simple yet powerful concept. Too many options can be paralyzing, but by removing the excess, by utilizing the inversion principle, we can see what truly matters. Naval takes this further by diving into complexity theory. The more I got into it, the more I understand the limits of our knowledge and the limits of our prediction capability. Complexity has been super helpful to me. It has helped me come to a system that operates in the face of ignorance. I believe we are fundamentally ignorant and very, very bad at predicting the future. I mean, I don't know about this inversion theory. I don't know about complexity theory or game theory or whatever. Everything mentioned here is unfamiliar to me. And this is why we're probably going to delve deeper in these theories as we go on in the next episodes about decision making, so we can get better and acquire this very, very important skill. Then there's economics and game theory. Microeconomics and game theory are fundamental. I don't think he can be successful in business or even navigate most of our modern capitalist society without an extremely good understanding of supply and demand, labor versus capital, game theory, and those kinds of things. Adding to that, Naval emphasizes on the importance of principal-agent problem. To me, the principal-agent problem is the single most fundamental problem in microeconomics. If you do not understand the principal-agent problem, you will not know how to navigate your way through the world. It's a very simple concept. Julius Caesar famously said, "If you want it done, then go. And if not, then send." What he meant was, if you want it done right, then you have to go yourself and do it. When you are the principal, then you are the owner. You care and you will do a great job. When you are the agent and you are doing it on somebody else's behalf, you can do a bad job. You just don't care. You optimize for yourself rather than for the principal's assets. The smaller the company, the more everyone feels like a principal. The less you feel like an agent, the better the job you're going to do. The more closely you can tie someone's compensation to the exact value they're creating, the more you turn them into a principal, and the less you turn them into an agent. And then he talks about compound interest. Most of you should know it in the finance context. If you don't, crack open a microeconomics textbook. It's worth reading a microeconomics textbook from start to finish. In the intellectual domain, compound interest rules. When you look at a business with 100 users growing at a compound rate of 20% per month, it can very, very quickly stack up to having millions of users. Sometimes, even the founders of these companies are surprised by how large the business scales. Of course, these principles require a foundation which Naval ties back to basic math. I think basic mathematics is really underrated. If you go in to make money, if you go in to invest money, your basic math should be really good. You don't need to learn geometry, trigonometry, calculus, or any of the complicated stuff if you're just going into business. But you want arithmetic, probability, and statistics. Those are extremely important. Crack open a basic math book and make sure you are really good at multiplying, dividing, compounding, probability, and statistics. I'm not entirely sure when these concepts will become crucial in the endeavors of my life or whether I'll find the time to immerse myself in them fully. But since they seem like timeless solutions to a wide range of challenges, business ones included, shouldn't they hold enough importance for me to make the time for them? He's swiftly moving from one idea to the next here, but another key concept is black swans. There's a new branch of probability statistics which is really around tail events. Black swans are extreme probabilities. Again, I have to refer back to Nassim Taleb, who I think is one of the greatest philosophers scientists of our times. That's a book I've been eager to read for quite some time, and I'm thrilled that he mentions it. Hopefully, this will be the push I need to dive into it for this podcast. Naval returns to the topic of math, bringing up calculus and its role in decision-making. Calculus is useful to know, to understand the rates of change and how nature works. But it's more important to understand the principles of calculus, where you're measuring the change in small discrete or small continuous events. It's not important you solve integrals or do derivations on demand, because you're not going to need to in the business world. And then there's falsifiability. Least understood, but the most important principle for anyone claiming science on their side is falsifiability. If it doesn't make falsifiable predictions, it's not science. For you to believe something is true, it should have predictive power, and it must be falsifiable. I think macroeconomics, because it doesn't make falsifiable predictions, which is the hallmark of science, has become corrupted. It's a lot to absorb, I know. Sometimes I wonder if I'll ever find the time to study all of this, but again, these are important. Important enough to make time for them. Okay, now what's about to come is absolutely crucial for making better decisions. If you can't decide, the answer is no. If I'm faced with a difficult choice, such as, should I marry this person? Should I take this job? Should I buy this house? Should I move to the city? Should I go into business with this person? If you cannot decide, the answer is no. And the reason is, modern society is full of options. There are tons and tons of options. We live on a planet of 7 billion people, and we are connected to everybody on the internet. There are hundreds of thousands of careers available to you. There are so many choices. You're biologically not built to realize how many choices there are. Historically, we've all evolved in tribes of 150 people. When someone comes along, they may be your only option for a partner. When you choose something, you get locked in for a long time. Starting a business may take 10 years. You start a relationship that will be 5 years or maybe more. You move to a city for 10 to 20 years. These are very, very long-lived decisions. It's very, very important. We only say yes when we are pretty certain. You're never gonna be absolutely certain, but you're gonna be very certain. If you find yourself creating a spreadsheet for a decision with a list of yes and no's, pros and cons, checks and balances, why this is good or bad, forget it. If you cannot decide, the answer is no. God, does that mean that I shouldn't necessarily share videos on Instagram? I mean, I know that I wanted to make the YouTube videos or the podcast. Yes, sure, I was already comfortable with making things without showing my face, but I was sure. I knew I wanted to do those things. I knew it was important for me to do them. I don't know. I did have a little doubt. Mostly for the YouTube channel, because that was the first thing I did. For the podcast, I didn't. I don't know. I'm not sure, so should the answer be no? Or is that just a way to get in the comfort zone? How do I know? That's very difficult. Let's go further. Run uphill. Simple heuristic. If you're evenly split on a difficult decision, take the path more painful in the short term. If you have two choices to make and they are relatively equal choices, take the path more difficult and more painful in the short term. What's actually going on is one of these paths requires short-term pain, and the other path leads to pain further out in the future. And what your brain is doing through conflict avoidance is trying to push off the short-term pain. By definition, if the two are even and one has a short-term pain, that path has long-term gain associated. With the law of compound interest, long-term gain is what you want to go toward. Your brain is overvaluing the side with the short-term happiness and trying to avoid the one with short-term pain. Working out for me is not fun. I suffer in the short term. I feel pain. But then in the long term, I'm better off because I have muscles or I'm healthier. If I'm reading a book and I'm getting confused, it is just like working out and the muscle getting sore or tired, except now my brain is being overwhelmed. In the long run, I'm getting smarter because I'm absorbing new concept from working at the limit or edge of my capability. So you generally want to lean into things with short-term pain but long-term gain. This is such a good advice, I find, and it has worked for so many things in my life. I don't know if it will for this particular thing, this particular problem I have, and I'm thinking about right now, but still. Okay, now let's move on to the last point here, which is, what are the most efficient ways to build new mental models? Read a lot. Just read. Reading science, math, and philosophy 1 hour per day will likely put you at the upper echelon of human success within 7 years. Learn to love to read. The genuine love for reading itself, when cultivated, is a superpower. The means of learning are abundant. It's the desire to learn that is scarce. Read what you love until you love to read. You almost have to read the stuff you're reading because you're into it. You don't need any other reason. There's no mission here to accomplish. Just read because you enjoy it. These days, I find myself rereading as much or more as I do reading. A tweet from Illa Sturgis, I think, said, "I don't want to read everything. I just want to read the 100 great books over and over again." I think there's a lot to that idea. It's really more about identifying the great books for you because different books speak to different people. then you can really absorb those. Reading a book isn't a race. The better the book, the more slowly it should be absorbed. I don't know about you, but I have very poor attention. I skim, I speed read, I jump around. I could not tell you specific passages or quotes from books. At some deep level, you absorb them, and they become threads in the tapestry of your psyche. They kind of weave in there. The reality is, I don't actually read much compared to what people think. I probably read 1 to 2 hours a day. That puts me in the top 0.00001%. I think that alone accounts for any material success I've had in my life, and any intelligence I might have. I'm gonna say that again, because that is so important. I think that alone accounts for any material success I've had in my life, and any intelligence I might have. Real people don't read an hour a day. Real people, I think, read a minute a day or less. Making it an actual habit is the most important thing. It almost doesn't matter what you read. Eventually, you will read enough things, and your interest will lead you there, that it will dramatically improve your life. Just like the best workout for you is one you're excited enough to do every day, I would say, for books, blogs, tweets, or whatever, anything with ideas and information and learning, the best ones to read are the ones you're excited about reading all the time. Here's a quote from Charlie Munger, and I know I've been talking about Charlie Munger for a while here, but if you're not familiar with Charlie, you can't really think of him without also thinking or mentioning Warren Buffett, and vice versa. Charlie was an extraordinary American investor, businessman, philanthropist, and the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. Truly a man of immense wisdom. We'll probably dive deeper into his life and insights in a future episode, but for now, here's what he said. As long as I have a book in my hand, I don't feel like I'm wasting time. Here's a fascinating insight coming up, particularly valuable for content creators. Everyone's brain works differently. Some people love to take notes. Actually, my note taken is Twitter. I read and read and read. If I have some fundamental aha insight or concept, Twitter forces me to distill it into a few characters. Then I try and put it out there as an aphorism. Then I get attacked by random people who point out all kinds of obvious exceptions and jump down my throat. Then I think, why did I do this again? Pointing out obvious exceptions implies either the target isn't smart or you aren't. I love that. Not only does it highlight the importance of not just taking notes on what we learn, but also putting our ideas out there, allowing ourselves to be vulnerable to criticism. This process helps us see reality for what it truly is, right? Wow, I've never thought about it like that before. I've always seen criticism as the downside of fame. But if you shift your perspective, if you detach your ego and embrace the feedback, you can learn so much and improve exponentially. And that takes us to another question. How does Naval Ravikant read books? I'll start at the beginning, but I'll move fast. If it's not interesting, I'll just start flipping ahead, skimming or speed reading. If it doesn't grab my attention within the first chapter in a meaningful, positive way, I'll either drop the book or skip ahead a few chapters. I don't believe in delayed gratification when there are an infinite number of books out there to read. There are so many great books. The number of books completed is a vanity metric. As you know more, you leave more books unfinished. Focus on new concepts with predictive power. Then there's this excellent question in the book. What can I do for the next 60 days to become a clearer, more independent thinker? Read the greats in math, science, and philosophy. Ignore your contemporaries and youth. Avoid tribal identification. Put truth above social approval. Study logic and math, because once you've mastered them, you won't fear any book. No book in the library should scare you, whether it's a math, physics, electrical engineering, sociology, or economics books. You should be able to take any book down off the shelf and read it. A number of them are going to be too difficult for you. That's okay. Read them anyway. Then go back and reread them. And reread them. I'm not repeating myself here. He's the one repeating himself. When you're reading a book and you're confused, that confusion is similar to the pain you get in the gym when you're working out. But you're building mental muscles instead of physical muscles. Learn how to learn and read the books. The problem with saying just read is there is so much junk out there. There are as many different kinds of authors as there are people. Many of them are going to write lots of junk. Your foundation is critical because most people are intimidated by math and can't independently critique it. They overvalue opinions backed with math and pseudoscience. When it comes to reading, make sure your foundation is very, very high quality. The best way to have a high-quality foundation, you might not love this answer, but the trick is to stick to science and to stick to the basics. Generally, there are only a few things you can read people don't disagree with. Very few people disagree on 2 plus 2 equals 4, right? That is serious knowledge. Mathematics is a solid foundation. Similarly, the hard sciences are a solid foundation. Microeconomics is a solid foundation. The moment you start wandering outside of these solid foundations, you're in trouble because now you don't know what's true and what's false. I would focus as much as I could on having solid foundations. Another way to do this is to read originals and read classics. If you're interested in evolution, read Charles Darwin. Don't begin with Richard Dawkins, even though I think he's great. Read him later. Read Darwin first. If you want to learn macroeconomics, first read Adam Smith, read von Mises, or read Hayek. Start with the original philosophers of the economy. If you're into communist or socialist ideas, which I'm personally not, start by reading Karl Marx. Don't read the current interpretations someone is feeding you about how things should be done and run. If you start with the originals as your foundations, then you have enough of a worldview and understanding that you won't fear any book. Then you can just learn. If you're a perpetual learning machine, you will never be out of options for how to make money. You can always see what's coming up in society, what the value is, where the demand is, and you can learn to come up to speed. I came up with this hack where I started treating books as throwaway blog posts or bite-sized tweets or posts. I felt no obligation to finish any book. Now when someone mentions a book to me, I buy it. At any given time, I'm reading somewhere between 10 and 20 books. I'm flipping through them. If the book is getting a little boring, I'll skip ahead. Sometimes I start reading a book in the middle because some paragraph caught my eye. I'll just continue from there, and I feel no obligation whatsoever to finish the book. All of a sudden, books are back into my reading library. That's great, because there is ancient wisdom in books. When solving problems, the older the problem, the older the solution. If you're trying to learn how to drive a car or fly a plane, you should read something written in the modern age, because this problem was created in the modern age and the solution is great in the modern age. If you're talking about an old problem, like how to keep your body healthy, how to stay calm and peaceful, what kinds of value systems are good, how you raise a family, and those kinds of things, the older solutions are probably better. Any book that survived for 2,000 years has been filtered through many people. The general principles are more likely to be correct. I wanted to go back into reading these sorts of books. And that's probably what I'll try to do as well. That is what we'll do in this podcast. Yeah, so I guess that's where I'll leave it. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast or YouTube channel, I'd really appreciate it if you did. Your support goes a long way in motivating me to keep chasing my hero and sharing this journey with you. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care and keep chasing your hero.